It's a great pleasure to be back in Utrecht. I don't know, this must be my 10th or 11th time, I think. But since 1990, pretty much every year, so. I don't think I can get permanent resident status, but I think it's my 11th time. But it's always a joy and a pleasure to be back. Unfortunately, I don't speak the language, so I have to speak in English. If I say anything that you don't understand, please feel free to speak up, and I'll either try to explain simply in English, or someone can maybe say the word in Dutch. Okay? I want to talk, as Ron said, about the unconditioned in Buddhism, Zen, and our own lives. Unconditioned, it sounds rather difficult, but I will explain what it means, so don't worry. But first, by way of introduction, in order to talk about the truth of Buddhism, the truth that is Buddhism, words can be used, but they must be used with great care. For the speaker, certainly. Also, there's a way to maybe listen to a talk on Buddhism or Zen. It's not quite like an ordinary talk about something. So I invite you to try and enter into the spirit, try to catch a glimpse, get a sense, realize something of what I'm talking about. And afterwards, I hope we'll have time for you to ask questions, have a discussion, whatever. Let me begin by asking, what is Buddhism? What is Buddhism? One simple way to explain it is to say it is a practical way of liberation, religious emancipation. From what? From what? From everything. And yet, at the same time, Buddhism says that all things, including we ourselves, are conditioned. So if the point of Buddhism is religious emancipation, liberation from everything, and yet we ourselves are just conditions, how can we get free from the conditions? You might think, well, I guess somehow you meditate or something and you transcend all the conditions of the world. That sounds nice, but if you seriously study Buddhism, Buddhism clearly denies any kind of a transcendental, supernatural reality beyond the conditions. So again, the question becomes even more essential, more crucial. If Buddhism is a practical way of religious liberation, how can we be liberated? We ourselves are nothing but conditions. And there is no transcendental heaven or reality. How do we do it? As you can see, this is a central question both practically and theoretically for Buddhism. So the rest of my talk will be to clarify what is meant by emancipation, liberation in Buddhism, and how it is done. Let me begin by the unconditioned in Buddhism. So I'll speak more generally. First of all, about the unconditioned in Buddhism, then the unconditioned in Zen Buddhism specifically, and then in our own lives more practically, okay? Let me begin by a quote attributed to Gautama Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha. This is from a sutra, but it is not a description or an analysis as many of the things in the sutras are. Especially the Indian sutras can be very metaphysical, very philosophical, and describe and analyze many things. This is from the sutras, but it's from a section called the Udana, Udana, which means something like an exclamation, a hallelujah, not an analysis, but the result of a realization. Gautama Shakyamuni was already awakened, already enlightened, but he was speaking with his disciples. And at one point, he realized something about awakening, about enlightenment, that he had never realized before. So he exclaimed, this udana came out of him. So please be careful. It sounds maybe a little analytical, but it's not. It's an udana, an exclamation. Let me read it. This is unconditional. Were it not for this, there would be no emancipation for the conditioned. But since there is indeed this unconditional, all conditions are emancipated. I'll come back to that quote a few times during the talk. And in a sense, everything I say will just be unpacking, opening up that quote. First, let me talk a little bit about what the conditions are before we talk about what the unconditioned is, okay? Our lives are conditioned by various factors: time, space, body, mind, environment, genetics, our past history, our present desires, our hopes, our dreams. In Buddhism, all of those things are considered simply conditions that make us what we are. In Buddhism, even we ourselves are said to be nothing but those conditions. In other words, there is no eternal soul. There is no unchanging self. This is what Buddhism in all schools teaches. What is there then? There are simply certain conditions that arise and cease. And we tend to identify, to hold on to. It's kind of like a tangle of things come together. It's just a tangle of conditions. But at some point, that tangle of conditions takes on a kind of self-identity. Me. This is me. This is what I am. But again, Buddhism says, look carefully. And that's a lot of what Buddhist meditation is. Look carefully. What is it? Is there really a self, an unchanging, eternal me or I in all these conditions? What is it? What is really there? Okay, that's a lot of what Buddhist meditation is about. For example, in Buddhism, it analyzes the self, what we call the self, and it says it is simply a group of sense faculties, the senses. First, the five senses is very simple. I think all over the world, the same five senses: hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, and feeling or touching, okay? The five sensations, right? So we hear things with the ear, we see things with the eye. But there's a sixth sense in Buddhism, and that is not the movie, The Sixth Sense, ESP, some kind of psychic thing. It's not that at all. It's simply consciousness or the mind. What does this mean? Again, the eye can see things. The ear can hear things. The nose can smell things. And consciousness, or the mind, can think and can feel things. It's a little more complex, but it's just a sense faculty like hearing or seeing. Again, the mind is not some kind of an eternal self, a substantial self. It is simply what is thinking at any given moment, or what is feeling, but it is not a self. Just like hearing sounds, thinking thoughts, or feeling feelings. This mind, this sixth sense, tends to be the one faculty that brings together the senses. So we see something and we can think about it. But again, Buddhism says, analyze what is going on. Is there some substantial self there or not? Look very carefully when you're seeing, when you're hearing, when you're thinking, when you're feeling. What is at the bottom of it all? What is at the base of it all? Once again, in Buddhism, what we call the self is simply six sense faculties. And again, the sixth one is simply mental consciousness, being aware of thoughts. But there is no self, no eternal self behind that. Okay? This is very basic teaching of Buddhism. To put it more generally, and I think this helps to have some understanding of Buddhism, even if you're interested just in Zazen, if you don't have any understanding of Buddhism as kind of a theory or a doctrine, your Zazen can kind of flounder and become lost. So I think this can be helpful. It's kind of intellectual, but it can be helpful. I just talked about the self, what we call the self, as being nothing more than the six sense faculties and their functioning. More generally, everything in the universe, according to Buddhism, has three marks or characteristics. Everything in the universe, including we ourselves, is impermanent. It is not permanent. It may last a very long time, but it does not last forever. Very much connected with the idea of an eternal self. There's no such thing. Everything is impermanent. The second characteristic is everything is, the Pali or Sanskrit term is dukkha. Sometimes it's translated as suffering. It's also the first noble truth of Buddhism. All things are suffering. It's too negative. It's not accurate. I translate it as all things are in dis-ease. Not disease, sickness, but not at ease, dis-ease. It's all connected. If things are impermanent, they cannot fully come to rest. They're like waves constantly according to different conditions. For example, the wave, the wind, the chill factor and whatnot, creating certain waves. They're constantly moving, but they're never fully at rest. And we ourselves experience that in our senses, desiring something we see, getting lost in our thoughts, getting angry about something that happened a long time ago. These kinds of things. But again, Buddhism says all things, analyze them, look carefully. They are impermanent and they are not at ease, including we ourselves. They cannot come to rest as they are, being something, being anything. They are changing. And the third characteristic is that all things are without a self. All things are without a self. This has a very positive meaning too. But just simply, again, all things are impermanent, without permanence. All things are without ease. They cannot come to rest. Dukkha, the first noble truth. And all things are without a self. You see how they're all kind of connected. They're all kind of connected. And they're trying to show us what's going on underneath what we think of as our self or our self identity. Please remember that this is the beginning, not the end of Buddhism. If this was the end of Buddhism, it would be pretty depressing. But there are four noble truths. Probably you know about them anyway. You can read about them. But so far, really, we've only talked about the first one. If you stop there, it's pretty depressing. But there are four. So let's move on. But does this sound a little strange to you? Does it sound a little strange? Some no. Nobody? I hope at least somebody says yes, because I got a good quote. Thank you. Let me read a quote and see if you can tell me what great Buddhist master said this. Quote, "I was intent on the things that are contained in places, but among them I found no place of rest, nor did they receive me, so that I might say, it is enough, and it is well." Do you know who said that? Anybody know who said that? The Bible, no. The Bible? This is a Buddhist lecture. You're close, though. St. Augustine. This is seventh book, seventh chapter of the Confessions of St. Augustine. He knew very well that he could not come to rest in being, and it's very clearly stated here. Of course, his answer was one of Christian faith. In the beginning, the opening of the Confessions, it's one of the most concise descriptions of the Christian faith, right? My heart will not rest until it rests in thee. Thee meaning God, of course. So he was able to find that rest that he couldn't find in being anything in God. In Buddhism, it's a little bit different. Why? Because in the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, pretty much God is assumed as the creator of everything. God as the creator. In Buddhism, they tend not to talk about an ultimate, absolute first cause like God. Rather, they speak more practically about here and now we can see the conditions that have made us what we are, that are creating our suffering, and we can get free from them. We don't need to know, well, what was the ultimate cause? My parents gave birth to me. Without my parents, there would be no me. But then without their parents, it kind of goes on forever, doesn't it? Buddhism, in a sense, is very practical. As I said before, what is Buddhism? A practical way of religious liberation. Because it says, right here and now, we are not at ease. Let's look into that and see if we can't resolve that. We don't have to ask, well, what was the first cause, the ultimate first cause? So it's a little different than the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic or Muslim tradition. But Buddhism does talk, again, more practically about the causes, the more immediate causes of our suffering or our dis-ease. For example, it talks about self-attachment, because we are attached to some condition as ourself. We are in dis-ease, because that thing itself doesn't remain. It also talks about ignorance. It sounds like a different idea, but it's very much connected. Because we are ignorant of what this really is, we become self-attached, and we suffer, because it's changing, but we want to hold on to it, but we can't, because we ourselves are changing. So, simply put, because we're ignorant, we don't know who and what we really are, we crave after things or people or lovers or a self. We crave after something to find that stability. But that only leads to further entanglements, further confusion, further self-attachment, further dis-ease. We can't solve the problem that way. So, if we speak of a core problem, what's the core problem in Buddhism? In Christianity, for example, maybe we can talk about original sin. Original sin. In Buddhism, we can speak more generally, but in a sense more concretely, about delusion, self-attachment, the delusion of a self as being, relatively speaking, the core of the problem. this complex of conditions becomes somehow attached to itself, and it is in constant dis-ease. That's why we feel the need for spiritual practices. For example, Zazen. It is a way to help untangle this mess. Let me talk a little bit about spiritual practices. For example, there are two extremes in spiritual practices that don't work. So please be careful. When you do spiritual practices, whatever they are, you must do them with great care. For example, one extreme is you have an understanding, perhaps, that all conditions are impermanent and you cannot come to rest in those conditions. So what do? You seek to literally eliminate all conditions, right? For example, the yogi, and I've seen them, they can do it. A yogi can go into a trance and eliminate, erase his consciousness at will. And you can burn his finger and he doesn't feel it. Maybe he does later, I don't know. But at that moment, when anyone else would say, you know, he would hurt. It doesn't hurt. He's not there. He has eliminated consciousness, literally. That's a very wonderful trick, perhaps, but it's, of course, not the solution to the problem. If you look at the life of Gautama Shakyamuni, the legend anyway, it says that he himself, before he was awakened, he tried these kinds of very profound meditations. And as soon as he came back to himself, he realized this was not the answer to the question. Because while I may actually get rid of the problem by eliminating any consciousness of it, it's only a temporary partial solution. When I come back to myself, when I come out of the trance, I'm still me again. The tangle is immediately there again. So, according to the legend, of course, Gautama rejected that kind of practice and went on to be awakened under the Bodhi tree. So again, trying to literally eliminate all conditions is not what we're after. Another extreme is to try to eliminate all the content. So for example, stopping up your ears, putting blinders over your eyes, or even going into one of those tanks, I forget what they're called, submersion tanks. In California, they were big in the late 60s, early 70s. You would get in and you would be floating in water, so it was like you were weightless. Your eyes would be covered, your ears would be covered, and it was, in other words, trying to eliminate all sense input. And you know what happened? Some people went into these things, and it was a wonderful experience. It was wonderful. It was euphoria. Other people did the exact same thing, went into these things, and it was hell. Why? There was one sense that they hadn't taken care of. Which one? Well, this was still functioning. So for some people, it was great. For other people, depending on what they were doing with this, it was hell. Obviously, that's not the answer. And if you really think about it or you really do it, try to go someplace where it's completely silent. And then just to be sure, put cotton in your ears. See if you can be in absolute silence. There is no such thing. It's an abstraction. Try it. And you'll see that eventually what you will hear is, I'm not sure what it is, but I guess it's your blood flowing in your ears. You can hear it. You can hear and feel your heartbeat. You can feel your pulse. And you can hear it as well. You can hear the blood flowing. There's no such thing as absolute silence. It's an abstraction. But even if there was such a thing, trying to achieve that is not really resolving the problem we're talking about, is it? Let's talk about Zazen now. What is Zazen? What is Zazen? I would say Zazen is being free of all conditions without eliminating them. Before I talked about eliminating either the condition itself or the consciousness of it, right? The sense itself, the conditions. the content. But once again, Zazen is eliminating all, I'm sorry, not eliminating, being free of all conditions without eliminating them. What does that mean? Let me show you. Those of you who would like to sit, please do. Freedom from all conditions without eliminating them. Of course, in the beginning, practically speaking, doing Zazen, and when I say Zazen, I don't mean the Zen Buddhist practice, I mean Buddhist meditation in general. In the beginning, it's very helpful to minimize the conditions. For example, this is a very nice place. It's very quiet. A car goes by, maybe, or a bicycle, but it's quite quiet. The lighting is about right, so it's not too disturbing. Right. I hope there aren't any unfavorable smells around you. Right. So in the beginning, for Zazen, it can be very helpful to minimize the conditions, right? The sounds, the sights, the smells. That's why you put your legs up here. You don't need to go anywhere. Your legs are folded away. You don't have to sit like this, but your legs are out of the way. They won't be itching. Your hands, you can maybe put them like this or just like this. You don't need to touch anything or feel anything, so your hands are out of the way in a sense. Centered, but out of the way, right? Your eyes, if you look around, you tend to be distracted. If you close your eyes, you tend to imagine, think about things, maybe even fall asleep. So you are told in Zazen to look down about 1 meter in front of you on the floor. You don't really have to look there, but just allow your vision to fall naturally there. You're not doing anything with your eyes, so they naturally fall about 1 meter in front of you. When a sound comes, like that just did, you hear it. Again, it's not eliminating the conditions. When you sit in Zazen, if there's a sound, you hear it. But you don't make anything out of it. You don't need to cogitate, to think about it. What kind of a car was that? Or they shouldn't be driving at this time of night in the city. They should make driving in Utrecht illegal. You can think all kinds of things. None of those thoughts need to come into your mind. If they do, just let them go. Again, when a sound comes, you hear it. There's nothing wrong with that. That is the condition at that moment. But you don't need to do anything with it. You simply hear it, and then it's gone. If a thought arises, if you need to think it, and then let it go. You don't need to think it and then say, oh, I'm not supposed to be thinking, so I'm going to try to erase that thought. That's just a bunch of other thoughts, isn't it? If a thought comes, let it come, let it go. If a feeling comes, feel it. Let it go. It's the same way with all of your sense faculties. Hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. You don't have to think anything in Zazen. But if a thought comes, let it come. Just as easily, let it go. Zazen is freedom from all conditions without eliminating the conditions. Let me put it more concretely, okay? I'm going to borrow Ron's shoe.
I wonder.
Yeah. Whoa, talking about the smell. Better let that one go real quick. A little tight because it's Ron's shoe, but it will do very well. Big heels, Ron. Self-conscious about your height or what?
Yeah.
Y'all see? Looks pretty ridiculous, doesn't it? Doesn't it? You're all sitting here. This is the Zendo, the meditation hall, and you all are in your stocking or bare feet. Nobody's wearing shoes, right? It looks kind of ridiculous and out of place, doesn't it? This is the ego. And as you can see, you are all free from ego. But I still have an ego. Now, what do we normally do? We want to get rid of that ego. So what do we do? Well, for example, we may take one of the conditions. It's my wife's fault. Or it's the boss or whatever. And try to pull that one, right? What happens? Well, maybe the knot gets a little tighter. And maybe your foot starts to hurt. You know that weird talk about suffering? Well, it starts to make sense, huh? It starts to hurt. Again, don't say, oh, well, the foot is the self, right? Well, this is just a bunch of conditions we're talking about, okay? But it hurts. It's a bit tight. And if I do this, it tends to hurt even more. Obviously, that's not the answer. So then we think, oh, it must be not my boss, but me. So then you start pulling on this one. You low-life scum. You shit. You're a piece of shit. Whatever. And guess what? Now it's even tighter. It hurts even more. Rather than solving the problem, we've just made it worse. What is Zazen? It's freedom from all conditions without eliminating them. Without eliminating them. What does it mean? This is Zazen. You can't take one side and undo it. You've got to take the whole thing, which is really nothing, but for you it's the whole thing. If we speak of subject and object, or self and other. It's very easy. People talk about how hard it is. Well, as long as you keep pulling on one side, it's impossible. But it's really not that hard at all. If you get the whole complex in Zazen. See how simple that was? Look, it's just that. It's really only one string. But you see how the conditions get all tangled up sometimes. It's really quite simple to undo. Now remember, in Buddhism, they don't say the self is absolutely evil and bad. It doesn't talk that way. Buddhism is much more balanced than that. It says, maybe there is no such thing. Or it's just a relative reality. For example, Gautama Shakyamuni, I don't think he had shoes like these, but he had probably some kind of sandals that he would go out when he went begging, maybe. Or maybe he had his own bowls to eat from. Well, when it was time to eat or time to go out, he would put his shoes on, I'm sure. Or pick up his bowls and not somebody else's, like I'm doing, put on somebody else's shoe. In that sense, of course, Gautama Shakyamuni had a self. He was aware of himself, and he made that distinction. But it wasn't a self-attachment. There's a subtle difference there. So again, Buddhism is not saying you absolutely cannot have a self. Well, as long as you're alive, in a sense, you have a self. But it depends on what you're doing with it. And how you're seeing it, and how you're being it, that really matters. Okay? So again, it's not absolutely evil or wrong. For example, this shoe. You should take it off when you're in the Zendo, but you might want to put it back on when you go outside. And you can learn to take it on and off, for example, in your meetings with others. Really, you know, it's just a shoe, so it's not a problem. It's not the ego anymore, really. It's just a shoe, and it helps. But taking it on and putting it off, it's really nothing. You know now it's really nothing, because you've been able to untie the knot, unloosen the knot, the whole complex. Okay? So again, Buddhism does not say, it's absolutely wrong, throw the shoe away. Well, sometimes it comes in handy. But you have to see it for what it is. You have to see it for what it really is and use it for what it really is. You know, there are expressions. Are many of you in the Zen group? Maybe you chant the Heart Sutra?
Some of you,
yeah. There's a very famous sutra, the Heart Sutra. Probably if you don't chant it, you've at least read it once. It's only about one page long, and it's a very precise, concise description of the Mahayana Buddhist awakening. And it says things like this. Practicing the profound perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, one thoroughly realizes that the five aggregates, all the elements, the conditions of the world, are empty, empty of self. Thus, all dis-ease is eliminated. The most famous statement from the Heart Sutra is, form as it is empty. Form meaning when you see something, the form of seeing. When you hear something, what is heard, right? Form itself is empty, empty of self. Empty is form. Empty of self is form. It also says, because of this, we realize the unborn, the undying. In the words I'm using now, the unconditioned. But again, not by transcending or going to some other condition. Rather, the conditions right here and now, emptied of self, of false self-attachment, are the unconditioned. That's why it says things like, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. What does that mean? First of all, that's the six sense faculties. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body to feel, and no mind to think. Isn't that strange? It's saying you have no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Do you understand that? You will by the end of the lecture. You'll see that you've always understood. There was a young monk in China who read that part of the Heart Sutra. He was supposed to memorize it, and he came to this part, and he said to his master, "But master, I have eyes and ears. Why does the sutra say I don't?" The Buddhist teacher didn't know how to answer, so he said, you better go see a Zen master, and he did. Logically speaking, rationally, it's, what do you mean, no eyes? How could you read that if you don't have eyes? How can you hear me if you don't have ears? What does that mean? Why do the sutras say things like that? Could they mean hearing without hearing, hearing without self, hearing that is empty of itself? What do they mean? We'll come back to this. It also says, again, this is from the Heart Sutra, very one page, but it's got a lot in it. It also says things like, there is no ignorance. I thought the goal of Buddhism was to get free from that ignorance, right? Self-attachment or ignorance. Now it's saying there's no ignorance. There's no extension of ignorance. Not only is there no ignorance, but there's no getting rid of ignorance either. Obviously, it's not talking about certain conditions or getting rid of them, is it? No ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, no dis-ease, the first noble truth, no dis-ease, no cause of dis-ease, no extinction of dis-ease, no way leading to the extinction of dis-ease. What are those? What are those? I'll read them again. There's four. Listen. No dis-ease, no cause of dis-ease, no extinction of dis-ease, no way leading to the extinction of disease. What are they? The Four Noble Truths. But it's denying all four of them. It's saying the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism are all a lie. Why? All four of them. Not just, you know, the first, second, and third. Okay, but the fourth one we got to hold on to. But no. They're all gone. Why? Again, this will be clear by the end or you get your money back, right? Okay. It even goes further and it says there's no wisdom, what we're supposed to realize, right? No wisdom. There's no attainment. There's nothing to attain. Every time you chant the Heart Sutra, you're saying that. There is, in emptiness, realizing emptiness, there is no attainment. Well, then what the heck are we doing here? Well, first of all, I think it's clear that these are not simply conditions that they're talking about. They're somehow going much deeper. They're not saying there is super conditions. There are transcendental, eternal conditions. They're saying there are no conditions. And there are no lack of conditions either. Very strange, huh? And it ends by saying this, what they're talking about is freedom from all hindrances, from all conditions. Fears, freedom from all fears, freedom from all delusions, nirvana. In a word, it is the unconditioned, what I'm talking about. It is unconditioned. I think you can start to see that in Buddhism, what we call self and what we call world are a little different than we normally think about them. Huh? Self and world have somehow been transformed. Huh? But where did we go to? To another world? To someplace transcendent, supernatural? No. We don't need to go anywhere else. Why? First of all, there's nowhere else to go to. According to Buddhism, there's nothing beyond these conditions. But second of all, we don't need to go anywhere else. Free of self-attachment within whatever conditions you are is the unconditioned, to put it very bluntly. So again, the beginning question, what are we liberated from? The conditions? In a sense, but that's secondary. Really, what we're liberated from is the knot of self-attachment. That's all. And with that, all conditions are free. The foot feels better. And you can move around freely. What remains? What remains? Nothing. Everything is gone. Didn't you hear all those negations? No. Now everything is here. Unbound. Unconditioned. Everything remains. Unbound and unconditioned. Except maybe that little knot of self. But really that was nothing to begin with. It was just a tangle of conditions. Well, let me try to get a little more concrete and talk about the same thing, the unconditioned, in Zen Buddhism. This tends to get a little more to the point. In Zen, there are a number of good questions that ask the same thing about the unconditioned. For example, please sit comfortably. I think we're finished with Zazen, but I'm not sure. Are we? Anyway. Please sit comfortably. One of the basic questions in Zen Buddhism is very simply, what is Buddha? What is Buddha? Buddha means an awakened one, awakened to the truth. What is Buddha? What is an awakened one? In other words, what is the unconditioned, right? Because if you're awakened, you are free from all conditions, right? So to say what is Buddha means what or who is unconditioned. And this was a very common question that monks were asking the master to try to get clarification for themselves. Listen to some of the answers to that same question. What is Buddha? One monk named Echo asked the master, what is Buddha? And the master answered, you are Echo. As simple as that. You, free of self, are Echo. But it's like a grammar school textbook. Right? Bob asks, what is self? You are Bob. what could be simpler? Zen tends to be much more direct than the kind of textual analysis in earlier Buddhism. But it's saying the same thing. What is Buddha? Well, in this situation, the master found it very appropriate to say, maybe this monk was thinking, what is that transcendent reality that I'm trying to attain? And the master said, it's you. It's you, free of self. Simple as that. Another answer by another master to the same question, what is Buddha? 3 pounds of flax, or 3 pounds of linen, like to make robes. Probably he had some linen there. Maybe he was having robes made for the monks. And so a monk asked him, what is Buddha? What is awakening? And at that moment, his eyes may have fallen upon the 3 pounds of flax. So he said, 3 pounds of flax. What's wrong with that? That was an answer to the question. It may not seem like one, but at that time, at that place, that was the perfect answer. Perfectly natural answer. The selfless answer. The answer of the selfless self. Another monk asked another master the same question. What is Buddha? And this time, the master said, a dry hunk of shit. Do you need to translate that? Not for Dutch people, they know that.
We know better than
I know you. Kids, they don't even speak much English, but they know all these kind of curse words, don't they? But remember, this is not uncivilized Dutch kids. This is religious discourse. This is a religious statement. This is a religious statement. Why? Well, probably that monk, the master knew that monk, and he knew that that monk was also looking up to some pure and peerless enlightenment, some perfect. He had seen the Buddha statue, and it was just flawless. And somehow, if he could be like that, then he would be awakened. But fortunately, he had a doubt. The monk had a doubt. So he asked the master, what is this Buddha? What is awakening? Show me it. And maybe they were walking in the street in Tang Dynasty China. What? This is about 1,000 years ago. And maybe there was some stuff on the floor. Maybe it was on his shoe. I don't know. So he said, a dry hunk of shit. That's it. At that time, at that place, that is it. No more, no less. Again, these are 3 different answers to the same question. They're the same answer, but they take different forms depending on the time and the place. They're all answering the unconditioned in the conditions that they're in. And they're totally free from those conditions as they maybe wipe the shit off their shoe. There are many other Zen mondo, Zen questions and answers that I could give. Actually, anyone would do to clarify the unconditioned, but yeah, maybe one more. Huh? Arne and I went to, where did we go this morning?
Amazvigar.
Did you get that? it was extraordinary weather, you know, sunny and snowy. But we walked around in the park. The birds were singing, and the trees were beautiful. It was very nice. And it reminded me of this koan. So let me, another koan. I don't particularly like them, but we'll stop after this. And then we'll go into the unconditioned in our own lives rather than talk about this stuff. A monk asked, both speech and silence are relative, that is, are conditioned. How can we be free from them? You see what he was asking? If I try to speak, somehow I get caught in the conditions. But if I simply try to be silent, I also get caught in that condition. That's just one condition. And so I can't realize the truth. And of course, he's not really just talking about speech and silence. He's talking about the whole complex, isn't he? Self and not self, right? Self and world, you and I, good and evil, life and death. Either way, I can't get free. I'm stuck. What do I do? Again, the question. Both speech and silence are relative, are conditioned. How can we be free from them? How would you respond to that? Be silent? Speak? Speak quickly? How do you respond to that? Both speech and silence are relative, conditioned. How can we be free from both of them? The master said, "How fondly I recall Konan, south of the Yangtze River in China. How fondly I recall Konan in early spring, partridges calling, flowers fragrant." He was quoting poetry from a generation or two, very famous poetry. So probably the monk knew it. It would be like me quoting Walt Whitman or something like that, huh? He quoted some poetry. It happened that this master came from that very beautiful part of China. So again, at that moment, the monk's question was, how can we get free from all conditions, from the condition of speech and silence? And the master says, well, for me, I remember when I was a kid in Konan, and the partridges, lovebirds cooing in early spring. See, they were freely communicating. There was no problem with speech or silence. Coo, 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 coo. The birds were cooing, you know, lovebirds. And the flowers, he was smelling them. Well, no, I have better close up my nose so I can experience the unconditioned. No. That was the unconditioned. It's a wonderful answer to that question, and I couldn't help but think of it this morning. There's a lot of other ones, but let me talk about the unconditioned in our own lives now. You might think, okay, Jeff, you quoted some sutras, you gave us some of these Zen koans, but it doesn't come any closer to us, poor, dumb Dutchmen, realizing this selfless self here and now, right? What good does that do? Too close to home, or what? I'm an American, so I can get away with this stuff. But the thing is, you're always... you're constantly losing yourselves, aren't you? Every time you read a book, every time you see a movie, every time you listen to somebody talking like you are right now, and every time speaking like I am right now, we lose ourselves, don't we?
No.
Did you ever get lost in a movie? Hello?
No.
You never got lost in a movie, never got?
I did. Mm-hmm. But the book's fast. It's fast.
That's the point. Good point. We need to clarify that, don't we, huh? But it's past. That's the difference, isn't it?
Yes.
Between being awakened and not being awakened, if we make a relative distinction. Ordinarily, we lose ourselves, but as you just well pointed out, we come back to ourselves, don't we? It becomes an experience. What if you lost yourself and you didn't come back? What if you lost yourself and you didn't come back? You might think, well, that's psychosis, schizophrenia. Was Shakyamuni the enlightened one, or was he schizophrenic? Was Jesus the Son of God, or was he perhaps schizophrenic or psychotic? Well, different people say different things, don't they? That's why you must be very careful with religious practice. Once again, we are constantly losing ourselves. Every time we get involved, we get into something, we lose ourselves. There's no other way you can really read a book unless you give yourself up to it, or watch a movie, or play with a child. Really, do anything. Do anything. We are constantly losing ourselves, but, as you well pointed out, we're constantly coming back to ourselves. That's the problem. But the point I'm trying to make is that this tangle is not real, and it doesn't even work very well. That's why you're always losing yourselves. But you're also coming back to yourselves. That's the importance of not only practice, but sustained over a long period practice. Why? It's not that untying this is so hard. It's not hard. If you do it the right way, it's very easy. It's not hard at all. But we're so used to pulling on one end or the other. But it's really not hard. It's only because the movement of our lives, social conventions help, right? Our family, our friends, everything is moving on in that direction. And now we're suddenly being asked, well, wait, let's step back and look at the source of it all. Well, we kind of do that, but then we're still moving. We say, well, I can't see it. Well, yeah, it takes some discipline to actually settle in and really see what is there. It's really not hard. But if you're so used to going out and going out, then it can take some discipline. You don't have to go anywhere else. You don't have to learn to go up or to go down or even to go in or out, really, just to be right where you are at every moment. When you fall in love, has anybody here fallen in love? Pretty stupid question for Dutch people. It doesn't even have to be a person. It could be a thing, right? A car. Well, when you... I'm an American. I don't even have a car, but I am an American. When you fall in love with someone or something, you lose yourself in that someone or something, don't you? And you find yourself in that someone or something. You find a self that you never knew existed before, and it's wonderful. What's the problem? As you well pointed out, pardon me pointing, but I don't know your name. Your excellent point. No, we don't we do lose ourselves, but we come back to ourselves. That's right. And with love, what happens? We lose ourselves, but it's only with that one person or that one thing. So, for example, when you love someone, there's no tension at all. It's like your shoes are off all the time, and her shoes are off all the time too. And you dance, and it's just beautiful. You know where the steps go. You don't even have to think about it. But then there's the other people, the other conditions, right? Possessiveness, jealousy. I want to keep this one for myself, right? Well, that's because the ground of ego is still there. There is some losing of self. We are constantly losing ourselves. You know what it is? We're all like little kids, right? What did we do when we were little kids? Our mothers taught us to tie our shoelace, and then we ran out to play. Before we get out the door, what happened? It was untied. Oh, shucks, I got to tie it again. Well, that's what we are. We're constantly trying to be something, to be someone, and we succeed for a while, but then, before we know it, it's undone. I was in Rome last week, and I went to see some Michelangelo. It's wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. And when I was coming out, there was an American. I didn't know him, but he happened to come out at the same time, and he said, precisely your point. Wow, that was great. It had already become an experience. It was already over. It was great, but it was already over. Now let me ask a question. Which is more, relatively speaking, which is more real? Being lost, looking at the Michelangelo on the ceiling or the Pieta, or 10 minutes later saying, it was really great. Let me tell you, man, there was this marble stuff and it was... We think that one, the second one, is the reality, right? When we describe it and we make it into something. But that's nothing compared to the actual lived, pure moment when we lost ourselves in the Pieta. That's where it comes from. Even simpler experience. A flower. We smell a flower. When you smell a flower... Is that simple enough for Dutch people? All right, smelling a flower, all right? Can you relate to that? When you smell a flower, you don't smell a flower. Only afterwards can we say that. What is there the moment you smell the flower? I mean, there's not even smell. There's just that. Then we can say, what a lovely rose, or whatever. I smelled the rose. But at that moment, what was there? We forget. We turn it into something, a condition. But at that moment, it was unconditioned. The whole world was there in that flower. The whole world was there, and we could say we were there, but not there. Does that sound strange? Does that sound strange? In a sense, yes, but I think you all know what I mean. Now, can you start to see what it means to say no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind? Because we don't have any of those things. What is really alive right here and right now is not a body, a mind, or anything like that. And it's not some self inside. It is absolutely nothing that is unbound. It is ultimate release. And it is always here, right now, so you don't have to look for it. It is always right here, right now. What's the difference? Once again, thank you for your point. Ordinarily, we lose ourselves. We're doing it all the time. But we come back to ourselves because that complex is still there. Fine, that's no problem. But what happens if you were to sit and practice deeply enough so that you actually experience, not just talk about like what I'm doing now, but actually sit through and experience very simply this? And you can know for yourself. And if you really want to be serious, this you can know for yourself. It's not that hard. If you really give yourself up to practice, you can experience that. But you know what? Pardon me, Ron. Then you've got to unlace the shoe.
They understand.
They understand. Why? Because even if you do this and you actually experience it, this is all it is. This is all it is. As you go through life, they can get all tied up again. And it can even get tied up again, I know well, as, hey, I'm enlightened. I'm not tied. And it's like walking around the Zendo saying, look, I have my shoes are untied. Isn't that great? Made enough. Sustained, continued practice. Of course, this is important to actually experience that, to know that there is no self. But then, and how to explain this? It's very difficult, but if you experience a deep awakening, you still may have many things to go through. And that's the importance of actually not only untying the knot, but unlacing the whole shoe until you can finally hold it up and say, this is it. It's just this one string. That's all. It's nothing. Look, that's all it is. I didn't do that, although I really was tempted. He's got a pretty fancy thing there. This is one of these double suckers. I wouldn't even know how to do that again. I better leave it. You know what I'm talking about, right? So again, real practice is not just to untie the knot, but to unlace the whole shoe. And then you know for yourself. And then you may be free to put the shoe back on again. Put it on or put it off. It makes no difference. Thanks for the shoe. So I think you can see the importance not just of practice, but of real sustained practice. And even if you have some kind of an experience or even some kind of an awakening where you realize this release, continue on. Don't hold on to that. Don't walk around in the Zendo. Look, my shoe is untied. Unlace it then. And that's, what does that really mean, Jeff? Well, it's very difficult to explain and it's not the same for all people, but there are things that will come up. There are walls that you may encounter even though there are no walls. Well, it has to do with your upbringing. It has to do with your relations with people. I know very enlightened people in Japan that are terrible in relating with other people. Well, I think maybe they have untied their shoe, but they need to do some more unlacing. It's not always the same thing. Even though you realize release from all conditions, particular situations, particular conditions, you still need to learn how to respond appropriately to that. And that's what those koan exchanges were showing. In that situation, a dry hunk of shit. In that situation, 3 pounds of flax. In this situation, you. Being able to respond appropriately in that situation to help the other person gain release. You can't make them find this release, but you can help them. One of the best ways to do that is to always respond to the person, the selfless self, rather than the ego. So even though the person may be all wrapped up in their own knot and how pretty it looks or how big it is, always respond to that person's selfless self. That's what the Zen masters were doing. That's what he said. You, as far as I see, you don't have shoes on. I was the only one wearing a shoe. You don't have a shoe on right now. Think about it. Maybe it's there. You don't have a shoe. Let me read that quote one more time and see if it makes a little bit of sense now, okay? This is unconditional. Were it not for this, there would be no emancipation for the conditioned. But since there is indeed this unconditional, all conditions are emancipated. Gautama Shakyamuni is not talking about me getting emancipated, because there is no me. He's saying all conditions in genuine awakening, all conditions are emancipated. That's completely different from saying, I got emancipated. That's an illusion. That's the supreme delusion, a self that gets emancipated. True emancipation in Buddhism is realizing selfless self and realizing that in everything, then you can see it in everything. The piece of shit, the other person, the friend, the enemy, the boss, the employee, whoever, whatever. Now you might think, well, yeah, but we need the self, right? Without the self, we couldn't make decisions. We couldn't even lose ourselves. Nonsense. Nonsense. Bankei, a Japanese Zen master a few centuries ago, put it very well. He said, when he was awakened, he realized, all things, all conditions, are perfectly resolved in the unborn, the unconditioned. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn. He says, how do I know this? How do you know this? If a car goes by outside right now, without even thinking about it, you could know that it was a car. If a cat meowed, you would know that was a cat. If a dog barked, you would know it was a dog. And you might think, well, that has to do with developmental training from the child to the adult. But at the moment of hearing it, even though you may be listening to a lecture, you know it's a car, or a dog, or a cat. How? It's not the discriminating consciousness at all. It's what Bankei calls the unborn that knows all this. It's only afterwards that we can make it into something. It becomes born as a thought. But at that moment, it is unborn. And we are constantly doing it. You walk down the street talking with your friend and it's crowded and people are coming the other way. Somehow we continue talking and we work our way around those people. How do we do that? Is it because we have a self or because we don't have a self? Again, this self-delusion is constantly slipping through our fingers. We're constantly losing ourselves, as I tried to show. But if the basis is not fully dissolved, we come back to ourselves. But it is possible, and actually not difficult, in actual practice, to fully let go of self, so that there is no self to return to. Then you are, at every moment, in pleasure and in pain, in happiness and in sadness, right there, fully. And that is the unconditioned, whatever condition it is. But again, the importance of sustained practice. For some people, it may take many years, like me, very dumb, very stubborn. It took me many years of sustained practice, but it may not take you that long at all.